Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Alex, and this is Time to Talk. Do you know how to be human? This is the question I am sitting on with today's guest, clinical psychologist, Dr. Sophie Mort. We have a chat about emotions and how we manage them.
You know, one of the things I really notice is that it's the fact that we fear so many of our emotions that makes them so much more overwhelming. Yeah. Whereas when you can externalize and visualize something like anger as the middle manager, it gives you some of the power back.
But also, we speak about the attachment types. Get clear on boundaries and figure out what it means to be human in a world that gives us an unnuanced view of humanity, especially on social media. Dr. Soph is the author of A Manual for Being Human, and we get into the core parts of what that means in this episode. As per, rate, review, and subscribe. Share the episode with your mates, your dates, and your familial ties. And don't forget, if you want to join the Time to Talk community, join us on Facebook, where we have chats weekly about mental health, the podcast, and more. Head over to alexholmes.co to find out more. Now, let's get into this heart-to-heart. It's time to talk. Oh, welcome, Sophie, to Time to Talk. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be on here because obviously you and I have chatted on and off kind of behind the scenes and on Instagram, and now we get to meet and talk. And so thank you so much for inviting me on.
It's a huge, huge pleasure. Like, I love all the stuff that you're doing. Your book, A Manual for Being Human, is great so far. As I've said, I've had been making so many notes in the book. And as you know, listeners know, I'm a super like psychology nerd. I'm really kind of, I love it so much. I love kind of finding out new things and learning about different stuff. So I'm happy to have this convo with an actual psychologist.
Yay! Yay.
So let's actually start with who is Dr. Soph?
Well, I'm just a regular girl. No, I am a clinical psychologist who's working very much like you, actually, to get psychology out of the therapy room and into people's lives, ideally before they need it, in a way that is accessible, makes sense to them, and meets them where they're at. Because I think we've all really been set up to struggle. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is there's almost a manual for everything, isn't there? If you want to fix your car, there's a Haynes manual. If you want to fix your socks, sew something, there's a magazine for that. But often when it comes to the very normal experiences that make us human, such as our emotions, we don't know the first place to understand ourselves. Mm. We don't know what to do when anger comes up, when anxiety comes up, when sadness comes up. Mm. In fact, what we normally do is try and push those emotions away, making them more likely to stick around. Mm. And then we criticize ourselves for struggling. Mm. So I'm trying to get more than the basic psychology out there so that when people struggle, they know what to do, know how to support themselves, and importantly, know how to show up for each other when their friends and family are struggling too.
Yeah, I see some of the big things that people don't really think about when it comes to psychology. Like, what don't we know about psychology?
For a really long time, that information was kept in dusty old textbooks, mm-hmm. behind therapy room doors, in the ivory towers of university, and really information that could be taught in school is only really accessed when people, I don't know about you, I don't know what you think about this, but I think a lot of people don't end up asking for support until they're really struggling. And then there are so many hoops that they have to jump through to get in front of a therapist, right? So waiting lists, maybe you're in an area that doesn't even have a service. Maybe you're able to pay for a private therapist but don't know where to start. There have been so many boundaries and barriers to finding out the basics. So I actually often think, rather than what don't we know about psychology, it's like, seriously, what do the people in your life actually know about psychology? Because most people just think we're meant to feel happy and everything else is bad.
And that's the thing. I think that with a lot of the stuff that I've been looking at in recent times has been, recently it's been a lot about trauma. I've been looking a lot into trauma and what that looks like. But also I think in the early stages of like delving into all of this stuff was about emotional education and what we do with those emotions. And I love this question I'm going to ask. Well, what is your favourite emotion?
Ooh,
because
it's definitely not happiness.
So let's talk about that. Why is happiness not your favourite emotion?
I mean, I love feeling happy, don't get me wrong. I think happiness has had too much airtime, right? I think happiness feels great. And obviously, when you feel happy, you're most likely to be connected to the people around you. The issue is, we have all been taught to strive for happiness in such a way that when we experience something else, we think there's something wrong with us. And actually, we can create a struggle around happiness. I don't know if you've ever noticed this. You go through a good period in your life. You're like, I feel like everything's so good. And then when it starts to slip away, you're like, no. I need to cling to that. I need to get the happiness back. And rather than recognizing all emotions are fleeting, even the most overwhelming ones, and that happiness will pass almost like clouds in the sky and will return, we often end up so fixated on trying to get the happiness back that we make ourselves miserable in the process. So I try to really focus on the fact that happiness isn't my favorite emotion because all of them are equally as important. What's your favorite one? I want to hear it.
So did you say what your favorite emotion was?
I didn't yet. I've managed to sneakily get around it.
Did I miss that? No, my favorite emotion, I would like... And it was the emotion I hated for a long time, and I hated anger. I really hated...
Oh my God, this is the one I'm going to say is mine. I can't wait for you to tell me why.
I hated anger because it was something that I didn't understand, and I always associated it with destruction and negative masculinity, and my ideas of what it meant to be a man was very much centered around rage. And being a black man, it definitely centered around rage. And it wasn't until I had a conversation with my friend Josh Rivers, who hosts Busy Being Black podcast. He basically had like a whole podcast episode like debating why anger is good. And he was like, yeah, it changes, it does everything. For me, I felt like I lost a lot of control or would lose a lot of control because I didn't understand how anger was showing up for me.
Yes.
It was really interesting to get to a point where when I get irritated, anger starts to bubble. Kind of conversation start to have with myself? What does that look like? Mm-hmm. Why am I having these feelings or something? What has it triggered? Mm-hmm. All of that stuff. I start to do this really weird self-examination.
Doesn't sound weird.
Where to push it.
Yes.
But I feel like anger's amazing because it forces creativity. In a really strange way. So but I'm interested to hear what you think about anger as well.
Okay, so anger is, it's so funny you said that because I was like, I'm going to wait to see what Alex says. But anger is my favourite emotion for similar reasons. So my experience as a woman was very much like, I'm not meant to be angry.
Right.
And actually I was one of those people who definitely I was one of those people who said, I never get angry.
Yep.
Right? Not realizing that I had like a river of rage running just below the surface.
Yep.
And it's because I had a very unnuanced view of anger. I assumed exactly as you said, it's destructive. But I actually had an experience where I spent a lot of time really tapping into anger and allowing myself to vent it and express it in ways that felt safe. So I, for example, one of my absolute favorite things is rage journaling. Ooh. Have you ever tried this?
No, tell me more about that.
Okay. So it turns out I basically for a while realized that I was really struggling with my emotions. I was starting to become quite numb and quite flat, actually, because I was so disconnected from my anger. So now one of my favorite things to do is you get a piece of paper and you write at the top of it the thing that's made you feel kind of the edges of anger. Because for some of us, we barely feel it, and some of us feel overwhelmed by it. So if you're getting in touch with it, it's just when you feel a little bit frustrated. For people who feel overwhelmed, it's that time. Okay. So you write at the top of the page the thing that's making you feel frustrated, and then you go for it. I mean, like, allow you almost like vomit the rage out onto the page. Yeah. Sometimes I'll find myself scratching my pen into the page, almost like tearing the page apart, allowing yourself to say the things that you would never dare say out loud, allowing yourself to actually go quite over the top with your anger. Then once you've written for 15 minutes, at the end, I tend to write three things that I feel I learned from this experience. Like, oh, wow, actually, when I had that conflict with that person, I was much more angry than I thought. Oh, wow, I allowed that person to violate my boundaries, but next time I won't because I'm going to do this, right? Then what you do, and this is the most important bit, is you tear it up. You destroy it so that no one else is going to read it. And you notice that if you allow yourself to rage journal, over a period of time, you start to notice patterns like, oh, I'm actually an incredibly angry person, particularly in these scenarios, particularly if I feel patronized, for example. And so rage journaling is my favorite way of expressing anger. I really like the fact that I've discovered a really dark side of myself that has like, very strong boundaries and gets very angry when those boundaries are violated. But what caused me to care about anger and the reason it's my favorite isn't just because I now have a healthy relationship with it. It's the fact that anger is such an important emotion. You know, if you think about our ancestors, it will have been anger that caused them to turn towards threats and fight, right? So say someone kind of stumbled into the tribe, or not stumbled, came into the tribe, this is like millennia ago, and stole resources. It was anger that overwhelmed our ancestors and caused them to go and fight to get those resources back. It kept us alive as a species. And as you said about creativity, when we experience anger, it is an energy that we can use to make change. You know, for example, if you've been broken up with, the anger stage is the bit that drives you out of bed as you think, have you seen me? Oh no, I am getting back out there. Yes. It's anger where you think, oh, I'm going to show you. Like there's so much useful energy to be found in anger, as well as it's the important thing that says exactly as I've said, oh, you've crossed something in me. There's an injustice here. And I can use this energy to ensure I put that thing right in the future.
Yeah. That is very, very interesting. So anger journaling, I can imagine that being so useful. So because what I used to do the morning pages for Julia Cameron.
Oh, I love morning pages. Yes.
Like, I need to get back into doing it, but because recently I've just not been getting up early enough to start that. Because I'm doing a writing group, and then I'm like, so I'd have to get up earlier than that. It's long. I'm just like.
Also, something's got to give. You can't do it all, right?
Nope. Yeah. So I just either wake up and do that thing or that thing. So I need to get back into doing the morning journals, morning pages. Mm. And in those pages, I was like, it would always start off really like romantic and like classy. I'd be like, oh, the morning, here I am at my desk. Da-da-da-da.
And then another day on this planet, I'm alive. Yes.
Page two, like that effing waste man was saying all this stuff about me. And I was just like going in, it's like getting it was getting harder and harder and harder. But I think that expressing it in that way, and then I think the value of that is the tearing it up.
Yes, 100%.
Because it's the impermanence of these things. It just moves. Yeah. You're like, oh.
Yes, and it's a great visual metaphor, as well as ensuring that no one else is going to find out quite what an angry, angry person you are. And it's funny because I wonder about for you, because I think, I wonder if this resonates with you. For a lot of us, anger doesn't just arise in the way that I just explained, as in response to an injustice. Sometimes it comes up as a guardian for us, right? So, and I think this is particularly true for men who've been told pretty much from day dot that they're not allowed to show vulnerability. I don't know if I assume you agree with that, firstly. Yeah. So if you're taught that you're not allowed to be vulnerable, what happens if you feel rejected, if you feel shunned, if you feel shamed? Anger springs up in your defense, right? The feeling of vulnerability is so intolerable that anger comes up in its place, protecting you. disempowering the other person, maybe tearing them down to try and get you back on an even keel with you. And that's obviously, that can be really destructive, right? If you're feeling rejected and instead of being able to express that anger comes up, it often ends up leading to rejection as you push the other person away. When you rage journal or anger journal, what you start to notice over time is what was going on underneath, right? So, oh, it seems to be happening every time someone cancels on me, or someone speaks over me, or every time I'm around that person who just makes me feel a little bit less than. So it's so useful in so many ways because it helps you uncover those patterns of why is anger here, as well as allows you to release and then shred it with rage.
The important thing though is also like, is the reflection that comes after it. Because if you write it all down and then you don't reflect on it.
Do you
have a suggested amount of time for the journaling process? Do you say like, all right, do this? I don't know if you do this with like your clients or whatnot. Do you say, oh, 8 weeks, do this, or like, and then see where you and see where you're at after 8 weeks? Or do you say do it in perpetuity because to, as a routine?
No, great question. Great question. So I think when you start off any journaling practice, you want to make it something you do each day. But there's a couple of things around that, which is one, when anyone starts a new habit, they're often excited about it at the beginning. So the first day they're like, I'm going to do 45 minutes. And maybe they do. And second day, like, oh, that was so great. You do another 45 minutes. Day three, though, they say, so I don't have 45 minutes. Oh, I'm going to have to skip it. Day four, the new habit is lost. So always when I suggest any new thing, it is do what you can manage. So, for example, maybe you do 15 minutes. If you can sustain 15 minutes for four days in a row, do that. It's more important frequency than length of time. Next thing is, actually, if you journal, you want to be changing topics every so often. So for example, say you spend 3 days writing about this relationship that's driving you absolutely wild with rage. That's fine. If you write about the same thing for 2 weeks, you're just going to ingrain the story rather than release it. Have you ever noticed that when you tell a story enough times, it becomes a truth?
Yeah. And I like people, it's like, I had a bit of a disappointment recently, which I was kept on, like, every time somebody asked me how I was, and then we were having this conversation, it would always come up. And I had to, and I had to start precursing and be like, I don't want to keep saying this story over and over again.
Yeah.
And I had to change and rewire the way that I look at it. Because I was like, I do not want to become this thing. Like, I don't want to become that. So, yeah, definitely, I understand 100%, what you're saying.
100%. And actually, I missed out the most important step of the rage journaling, which is once you've finished it and once you've finished it and have written those three statements, you must reread it. And that's what you do before you shred it. I know. But I have to say the rereading, the reason it's so important is because it gives you that reflective period that you're saying. But also often it's hilarious. I really mean, like, I once, this is a real share. I once really pushed my rage in the journal because I really needed to show myself I could be angry without basically exploding. So I really pushed how angry I was going to allow myself to be because I was so afraid of anger that I allowed myself to, in this journal, bludgeon someone to death.
Okay.
Well. These are just thoughts, just writing. I needed to see how angry I could be without it actually destroying me. And so I was like, right, I'm going to beat you over the head, blah, blah. Anyway, when I reread it, the opposite of, so my fear thought was, if I allow myself to be really angry, I'll never come back from the brink. Yes. The reality is I read it, started laughing uncontrollably as I had this vision of me, ridiculous. I think I'm quite ridiculous, like ridiculous me ever doing anything violent. And it was the most amazing release to think, oh my word, I'm allowed, there's a safe space that I can vent my rage no matter how strong it is. I can come back for the brink. And actually, when I read the thing I fear, I find it so funny. I know I will never do those things. So there's a real purpose. When you do that rereading, that's when you get that reflective period. And that's when you, over time, notice your patterns.
Okay.
I'm not violent.
Just in my journal. And anger. So that's good. When it comes to, it's just anger is just such, I think I kind of made anger much more of a comical thing over time. And I think, I know that you probably watched Inside Out. Have you seen?
Yeah, of course.
Like, I love that film for various reasons and obvious reasons. But when it's just the, and then when I saw Anger there, just like this squat middle manager, like it just really killed me. So I was like, okay, so it makes sense for that to be, for that to kind of be the way that I look at all of these emotions in a room, and like who's over talking who and who's doing what, and trying to figure out like how to protect me essentially.
Yeah,
with what they've got.
100%.
Yeah.
And it takes away the power. You know, one of the things I really notice is that it's the fact that we fear so many of our emotions that makes them so much more overwhelming.
Yeah.
Whereas when you can externalize and visualize something like anger as the middle manager,
it gives
you some of the power back, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly you're like, ha ha, oh, I see. Okay, you do have a role. You're allowed to be there. And I actually feel kind of a little bit more powerful now that I visualize you not as something that's going to destroy me.
Yeah.
And the importance of that film is exactly what you say. We recognized for the first time that film was, considering that was not that long ago, it's quite worrying that we're only just sharing that message in society, that all emotions have a purpose.
Right.
All of them.
Yeah.
There is no right, no wrong emotion. They're all useful. They're all energy for change.
Yeah. And I think the one that frightens me the most, the only one that is fear. Because I'm just like,
oh, yeah.
Because fear just literally just pops up there like, hello. Like, you know,
over here,
we're going to bring anxiety, we're going to bring shame, we're going to bring all of that in here. Like, you know,
just open
the floodgates to all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, that is actually really, really interesting. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. That was.
Oh, no, thank you for sharing yours too. I did trap you into telling me yours before I told you mine, but.
Just have a quick break here. Are you aware that I have a book club? This month, we are reading The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris. Harris is a doctor, therapist, and coach, and by using the methods of acceptance and commitment therapy, has devised this book to get us out of the trap of happiness and more into the ideas around what it means to be compassionate to ourselves, delve into acceptance, and create a life for expansion. We will be diving into that book on August 13th, right here on Time to Talk, so it's not one to miss. Grab your copy, get your Googles on, and bring your notepads. Do you have a suggestion for a new book to do for future book clubs? Let me know. Join the Facebook group. The link is in the description. Or drop me a message on Instagram or email me, alex@alexholmes.co. Anyway, time to get into the show. Let's talk about the current nature of social media and psychology. Do you understand what boundaries are?
I think that social media has done something incredible. Mm-hmm. It has brought the conversation of mental health and psychology to the masses. Mm-hmm. It's very low barrier. As long as you have internet and a phone, or, you know, device, you can access information about psychology. However, a lot of the information out there is deeply unnuanced. Yes. So, for example, I think this is what's behind the current understanding around boundaries lacks the nuance it needs.
Okay.
So I hear people, for example, that saying, it's just my boundary around something that is actually them just telling someone else what they want them to do.
Okay.
So a boundary, for example, is the rule, is the line between you and me. So it's where you end and I begin.
Mm-hmm.
They are my hopes for relationships. We could call them rules, but they are a range of expectations and wishes. Some of them are flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's say a flexible boundary of mine is timing. Yeah? So I would rather, obviously, the people that I meet turn up on time.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone doesn't show up on time and they tell me why, I'm like, cool. Yeah. And the boundary is in order for me to feel respected around my time and energy, I need people to show up on time. But it's a flexible boundary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A rigid boundary, however, for example, is around consent.
Okay.
Yeah. So, for example, if I'm on a date with someone, it's an absolute hard boundary of mine that if I say no, it is respected.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of my personal rules. Some are flexible, some are rigid.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of people use it as control. Nedra Tawab said this. Nedra said this brilliant example of it recently, she's so great. And she gave the example of someone not being able to drink and then saying to their partner, well, I'm not allowed to drink, so you're not allowed to drink. That's just my boundary. That's not a boundary. That's a demand.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's a control request. Yeah. So I think at the moment boundaries are a hot topic, but I think they're misunderstood. And I think it's the fault of social media, which has these like short, snappy subtitles and text.
Yeah. So I always considered boundaries as something like, because so I like what you've said, and it's made me think about the way I think about boundaries.
Go for it.
I thought about it. I thought about them as they are, obviously, they are the borders of, you know, when somebody else begins and you start or ends start. But what about when someone crosses them? How do you follow through with the consequence or the result of that boundary being crossed? I look at it I looked at it as this thing where it's just like you're in a property. Like this is what I put in the post I wrote, and I was like, you're in a property, and if you breach the property's boundary, anything that happens in that breach is pretty much your fault. Dogs come and get you, like, you know, alarms go off, you know, there's a bear trap. I don't know, like, you know what I mean? There are things in place because you have crossed that boundary. If you stayed behind the boundary, then you're safe. Like, you know, arrive on time. Don't insult me in public. Like that. Don't insult me at all, but don't do those things in public.
I'd rather you didn't insult me at all. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But don't like tease me like that if I've told you not to, you know, in those kind of things. Like, okay.
I totally agree. So I love this visual metaphor, right? But if you imagine that you are the house and you've decided where your fence is, there are certain fences that are permeable, right?
Okay.
So for example, there are people I love who can tease me and actually probably insult me to the ends of the earth, right, and the punishment will be not very severe. I'm thinking about my siblings, for example.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there are different places, that fence around our energy, our time, and around what we allow is movable, and it depends on the person that you're talking to, and it depends on what they've done, right? But consequences are an extremely important part of boundaries. But first thing, it's kind of hard to punish someone for violating a boundary of yours if you haven't set it with them in the first place.
That's the point. Yep.
Yes, right. So say, for example, I had a friend who never turned up on time and I was just getting more and more angry.
Yeah.
It is better to communicate something after the first event rather than wait till the 20th time when you explode on them and they're confused as you've seemed to be fine for the last 19 episodes of this behavior. So there is a way to communicate what you need with people before it gets really tricky, such as maybe with the first person when they arrive and say, sorry, they're late, be like, actually, it's okay this time, but next time we arrange, can you let me know in advance when this is going to happen? Just because I have other stuff I've got to do.
Yeah.
It's gentle, but it's clear. Yes. You don't want to be rushing in after the damage has been done. I expect, though, with my boundary around consent, that I don't need to communicate, because that's a kind of a law, really.
Yeah.
So if I say no to someone, I feel like I don't have to communicate. If you violate this, I'm going to do X. Mm-hmm. Now, the important thing is once you've communicated your boundary, you stick to the outcome like you've said.
Yeah.
So I used to work with parents who, for example, they'd be trying to set a boundary around sweets with their kids.
Okay.
And so say, for example, they've told their kids, okay, so this week we're not going to have sweets after school or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid goes in and is like, can I have the sweets? And the parent's like, no, not today. Do you remember the rules? And the kid then escalates their behavior, getting louder and louder and louder. Maybe they throw themselves on the floor, start kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
If the parent at this point goes, oh God, okay, let's just go get the sweets, what does the child learn?
That kicking and screaming gets answers and results.
Yes, exactly. So the parent does something that makes total sense, right? Yeah. They want an easier life. They don't want to be in a street with a screaming child. But the child, it's not that the child is nasty. I was going to say a worse word and had to come back to it. Less, you know, rude word about children.
I was there.
It's not. Yeah. It's not that they're intentionally doing this.
Yeah.
Unconsciously, people are always testing your boundaries.
Right.
And if you say you have a boundary and you give in on it, people just learn, I just kick and scream louder and I'll get my own way.
Okay.
Or I just keep doing that thing and she'll give in. So boundaries, they're requests. They're rules around our lives. They protect our energy and our time and our personhood.
Yeah.
Some of them are flexible. Some of them are rigid. But they all require consequences. Some of them will be gentle. Some of them will involve cutting that person out of your life.
Mm.
Mm. And some of them in the consent situation may involve the police,
yes.
Right? So they're all different. We have boundaries for everything in our lives and they're all slightly different.
Okay. That is very nice and
clear. Did that tie into your visual?
So I think that was very clear. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. Just a quick question, because you spoke about consent. What did you think about I May Destroy You? If you saw it, did you watch it?
When did you make it?
I May Destroy You. It's a show.
Oh, I May Destroy You. Yeah, sorry. I thought you said I made a story on Instagram.
No. Sorry.
I loved it.
I said that
yes,
in one breath.
Yes, amazing. Yeah. Yes, I May Destroy You, yes.
Yeah. I found that was really good. I think it was a good articulation.
It was incredible.
On consent as well. Yeah, I thought that was good. But I'm always interested to see what people think about it. It made a lot of people uncomfortable. Some people never watched further than like the first two episodes because it was a lot.
It was a lot. I think we need to get uncomfortable and we need to be having those conversations. I'm not sure that everyone is ready to watch something, especially if someone's been through that kind of situation before.
Mm-hmm.
Watching her slowly piece together through flashbacks what had happened to her is very distressing.
Yeah.
But I think we absolutely need to see those kind of stories. That not only was that an incredible piece of work,
mm-hmm.
it had so much learning to it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just about consent, but what flashbacks really look like.
Yeah. And memory and
mm-hmm.
And what that means, and reliable memory as well. I always find it interesting. This is why I love psychology so much, because we are still all trying to figure out what it means to be human.
And often we do think it's our memories, right, mm-hmm. that makes us who we are.
Yeah, and identities. But, you know, those memories can almost always be unreliable.
100%. Every time you access an old memory, you change it.
Okay.
So it's really a tricky one. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, if you think back to something that you did with friends from when you were younger, almost every time you tell it, the story either becomes more narrow and focused on the things that have been repeated,
mm-hmm.
or someone embellished it once, and then that's that new embellishment has been
becomes
tied into
the story
of when. Yes. Yeah. So our memories are actually, they obviously have a nugget of truth,
mm-hmm.
but there's often, you know, these little different jewels and gems and bits and pieces that we've added on top. And that's actually something that really bothers me about Instagram right now, is there's this really wonderful thing that you talked about in terms of trauma. Mm-hmm. I think it's being talked about more and more on Instagram, but again, in a very unnuanced way.
Yeah.
So for example, I now have people reach out to me who say things like, I don't remember aspects of my childhood. Does this mean I experienced trauma that I am unaware of? And I'm like, no, it does not mean this. Some people, yes. If you have lost memories, it does link to trauma. But what we know about memory is your early memories are very fragile, right? Actually, we don't lay down memories till roughly 2.5, 3. Even after that, people inaccurately date their memories. If you imagine memories almost being, even though we don't have limited space in our head, it's helpful to imagine it almost like computers, you know, when you're trying to compress a file. Mm-hmm. So lots of those early fragile memories, if you haven't accessed them, almost just disappear. They get overwritten.
Mm-hmm.
So very few people understand memory. Very few people realize it's very normal not to remember your childhood. It's not a worrying sign at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of the memories you talk about each day are very much affected by how you told them before.
That is so true. Because when you, and I always think about this, like when you think back to your childhood, and obviously I want to get onto siblings in a minute. So this is a nice way to kind of go into that. But when I'm having conversations with my siblings, I'm the oldest. So the memories that I have tend to be a lot clearer of a situation.
Yes, because you're older. Yeah.
Than my siblings. Oh, I don't remember that happening. I don't remember this. I don't remember that. And I'm like, we had the conversation. I was definitely 10, like, because this happened at da-da-da-da. And they're like,
yes.
No, don't recollect.
No idea what you're talking about. Yes.
And then your parents are like, well, this definitely happened because...
Yes.
Parents, you know, so they would be there, obviously adults at the time, so they're gonna have access to these things a lot more. And I've always just found it interesting that we can all have the same experience but remember everything so differently.
And oh my word, because perception though as well, right? So the first layer is our memories are fallible. Mm-hmm. Yes. Second thing is it matters what we pay attention to, right? So I don't know about you, I lose my keys a lot in the house. I'll just put them down and then be like, oh, where have they gone? And I see people all the time say, oh my word, I think I have a memory problem because this thing happens. I'm like, okay, let me watch you. And I'm like, no, you just had a lapse in attention. You were talking to someone else or you were doing this thing. Mm-hmm. You remember the stuff you pay attention to, which normally means the highly emotional things.
Yeah.
And so the third thing is perception, right? So the siblings thing is particularly interesting because nearly each sibling in a family interprets everything that happens around them based on what they fear to be true or what they hope to be true. You know, for example, most siblings remember one of the siblings being preferred by a parent. Yes. And that golden child often remembers things quite rosily if they genuinely were the golden child.
Yeah.
And the other siblings remember everything through frustration, as in like, oh, well, I was never the favorite. So that was terrible. Those things they said to me didn't matter or they were actually secretly hating me. Mm-hmm. That's only one example because I'm the youngest.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So I was actually often, I was actually often the golden child sometimes. Yeah, memories are fallible and they're affected by what you perceive to be happening around you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love this. I love this conversation. So to get onto siblings, I find it interesting what you put in. You've got a chapter, the very beginning of the book is caregivers, siblings and our family environment. And I'm very big on the family system. I'm super interested in it, which is kind of why I'm doing what I do, because I'm really interested in what that looks like and how we kind of grow in that. How important is birth order when it comes to siblings?
So it's important, but it's not everything.
Okay.
Yes. Because if you think that we're being affected by everything that happens in our lives, every moment of the day, we have to treat these things kind of anecdotally, but there are patterns. So for example, I'm going to say, I know you've read the book, but I'm going to say this patterns we tend to see. And then I'm going to ask you if, as the older child, this did resonate.
Okay.
So, for example, it tends to be that the oldest child obviously comes into the world. First child gets a lot of attention, hopefully positive attention, love, nurturance. They're often, you know, quite well protected because the parents are thinking, oh my word, this child, I hope nothing happens to it. Okay.
Don't want to break him.
Yes, exactly. Has he stopped breathing? Second child comes along. This is kind of quite a serious fall from grace for the first child, right? Because they got all this attention and now there's someone else who's getting more attention. I'm going to talk about it as if there's always three. I know some people have no siblings and some people, you know, they're one of two and some people have many more, but it's just easier to think like this. Then if a third one comes along, the second one is now the middle child. Okay. So the oldest child tends to become the responsible one because they are often praised for the times when they step up and look after their younger sibling. Often because they are praised for, well, they're given the responsibility because they're older, and often because they're praised for taking it on. They take that kind of leadership quality often into their later life. The middle one, I heard about the middle child recently being called like the flyover states in America.
I am so finished. Wow. Because it makes so much sense.
Okay, good. I can't wait to hear. So because the middle one, they temporarily got the most attention, but another one came along and now they are no longer, they are neither the oldest, who is the responsible one, nor the youngest, who everyone's now concerned about. So often what happens with the middle child is they feel a little bit overlooked, but they adapt by turning to friends outside of the family. They tend to work on their social skills and get their connections through friends in school, for example, or somewhere else. They then tend to develop very good skills at negotiating, having conversations with everyone in the family of every age group. But they often report feeling quite left out. So then the youngest one is normally the one that's, by this point, the parents are kind of sure that kids are quite robust. They've also maybe started to be a bit like, oh, God, I'm tired. Mm-hmm. So the youngest one starts to get away with murder. Mm-hmm. So they then tend to be the kind of cheeky one that everyone kind of envies, who can kind of do no wrong. But often because the siblings, and this isn't always the case, but often because the siblings start to think it's kind of unfair, the little one tends to become the cheeky chappie in order to, you know, keep the attention going, mm-hmm. to still fit in within the sibling relationship. Okay. So those, all of those qualities are about adapting within a family, and they tend to follow us into adult life. So does that resonate with you?
So it resonates in some ways and not in others, basically because of the mishmash of my childhood of what that became.
Okay, yes.
And obviously I'm the oldest. I have a younger sister, 7 years apart. Mm-hmm. Family, we had a death, so therefore cousins came to mm-hmm. live with me. They came into our home as part of, our family grew just overnight.
Wow.
And so instead of me being the oldest of one, I became mm-hmm. the oldest of four.
Oh my word, okay, yes.
But they were both bang in the middle of myself and my sister.
Yes.
So then they became
middle.
The middle children.
Yes.
It probably would have been different if my cousin was older than me, and then it was me, and then their yes. brother, and then my sister. It would have been, yes. the system would have been completely different, but that's just how it yes. ended up being. But then, yeah, so while I identify with the responsibility, I got my phone first, ooh. I got my keys first, I had to pick people up, I had to drop people off, I had to be home on time. I could not hang about at, like, chicken shops after school or
yeah.
be a vagabond like everybody else. I had to be at yeah. home. School finished at 3:20. My mum expected me home by 4 o'clock.
Yes.
Like, that was just the latest I could ever be home, especially. And when the clocks went back, even when yes. it got darker, I had to be home earlier. I had to be home before the sunset. Yeah. So, yeah. So that
was it the same rule for your sister who was 7 years younger?
So, now, because she was 7 years younger, she did get overlooked a lot in the early stages, because obviously it was a huge shift of like attention that had to happen for like at least 2 to 3 years, because she was around two when that all happened. So all of that stuff kind of had to happen. So there was a huge lifestyle shift that was altered there. But ultimately she just became I'm just doing this because I am. Like, she's very lucky. Yeah. Fortunate anyway, but she's very lucky, very confident, very like, and it wasn't always that way, but you know, as they kind of grow, because they hear conversations, they learn things yeah. quite quickly, like the conversations that are being had when she's in what, year 5, and everybody else is like what, year 8, 10, 11, and yeah. all these different things. So.
Well, siblings are a gift, yeah. right? I know that they're your cousins, but your structure is still everyone yeah. in the same home, yeah. and you just learn so much. They teach you invaluable life skills, such as conflict.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But you've just said exactly, I suppose, what you've just spoken to exactly what I started this with, that there are patterns that we see follow through life, but there are so many other factors that intervene in life, such as grief, right? The shift of attention will, I'm assuming, also have not just been around the structure changing, but around supporting people who've lost someone.
Yep.
Well, everyone lost someone, but particularly the children. Mm-hmm. And gender. Right. So it's very different having an older son and a younger daughter than if you have an older son and a younger son, because the younger daughter almost always will naturally be given more kind of curfew or rules, right? Because we tend to worry more about young girls. Mm-hmm. So there's so many factors at play. And
so
I think
much context, yeah.
So much context. And in A Manual for Being Human, when I wrote it, one of the things that I knew I couldn't do was write a book that was about one topic, because that's not how humans work, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, your child is important, incredibly important, mm-hmm. but so is your DNA,
yep.
right? And so are the life events that happen later in life. Mm-hmm. And so is the media and marketing you consume every day. Mm-hmm. And so is the prejudice that exists in society. Mm-hmm. There is rarely one thing and only one thing that shapes who you are. It's every second of every day. It's that person you walk down the, you know, when you walk down the street and someone smiles at you mm-hmm. and it suddenly brightens your day.
Yeah.
Or it's that person who sends you the nasty text message or who insults you in public, mm-hmm. right? We are being shaped all the time, but our childhood is definitely fundamental in terms of,
yeah.
it's the soil from which we grow.
Yeah. I always find it interesting, especially when new children enter the world, new humans enter the world. I was like, okay, so we got a new human in this joint. Like, what's going on? And I'm observing them like quite often, saying like, okay, so how are they interacting? Like, what's going on there?
Yes,
and all that stuff. And I find it super interesting, just in general. But I love how you kind of linked that to attachment styles. And again, as you've said previously about the kind of the barrier to entry via social media, I remember there was a point in time when everybody started doing these attachment tests.
Oh yes.
And so I thought that was a spider.
Going on dates and getting their new date to do the attachment style quiz.
Yeah, attachment style. Like, I spoke to Charlotte Fox Weber. I don't know if you do you know Charlotte Fox Weber?
I know this person's name.
She's a psychotherapist, but she worked. She has this therapy platform called The Examined Life.
But, I know exactly what you're talking about. Sorry, I was being.
She spoke about attachment types, and I was trying to run around and do these tests just to try and figure out all these things. And I love how you've kind of broken it down, because I've spent a lot of time with attachment types. I've read Attached. Yes. I'm aware of my attachment.
Yes.
I've spoken to my therapist. We're working on things. Okay.
Amazing. And, amazing.
But I love how you've broken it down with regards to avoidant, obviously anxious, secure, but you said avoidant attachment is like a cat.
Yes.
This book spoke to me because as you can tell, I'm very visual and like audio things. So like, so when I think, so I picture a cat there, and then you said, and then you said, the anxious is like a puppy.
Yes. And bouncing around like, hi, initiating contact continuously.
So let's talk attachment types.
I'd love to.
Let's delve in there. So what are they exactly, and why do they matter?
Oh, great question. I like that you used your interviewer's voice did it.
I went into the BBC.
I loved it. Okay. So essentially the word attachment just means bond, right? It just means relationship between two or more people. Mm-hmm. Your attachment style, we can imagine, is like relational programming, or we can imagine it's a blueprint, a roadmap, which you use to understand relationships in your life. And essentially, it develops in your very, 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 very early life. So say, for example, your bond, your attachment with your caregivers, so whoever it was that raised you, was attuned to your needs. I'm not saying they responded every time you cried all the time, right? I'm saying that they just met your needs in the way you needed them to. They saw your emotions, made sense of it for you, and soothed you. If they did this consistently, we usually imagine that people develop a secure attachment style, right? The belief that other people can be there for them and will want to be there for them. If you have a secure attachment style, generally it means when you meet someone later in life or at any age, you're not threatened by it. You believe that they can be there for you and will want to. It's not arrogance, it's incredible. And we believe that about 50% of the population have a secure attachment style.
Okay.
Then insecure attachment style, there's actually more than just avoidant and anxious. There's also disorganized, but we think that's about 2% of the population. So I won't go into that too much here, but essentially you can imagine it that the child tried the avoidant attachment style, tried the anxious attachment style to stay close and stay safe, but neither worked. So they ended up, instead of having a distinct plan, had to just keep changing what they did each time. So the avoidant attachment style, as you say, is like a cat. Mm-hmm. I have an avoidant attachment style. Mm-hmm. This means that if you have an avoidant attachment style, it tends to mean that you learned early on that people won't necessarily meet your needs, that they reliably won't meet your needs. Doesn't mean that, like, I had a great relationship actually in my childhood with certain people, but other people, for example, might say to you when they see that you're distressed, oh, you're just tired. Right. So you learn early on that certain people will reliably not be able to show up for you. So what do you do to cope? You shut down. You become hyper independent. Mm-hmm. You become that child and then that adult who, yes, has close relationships, but holds people slightly at arm's length and never asks for help because you don't need to. You can do everything for yourself. And the reason it's like a cat is because you interact with people on your own terms. You can nuzzle up to that other person like, oh, hello. But if they nuzzle back too close...
For too long.
You scratch them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't scratch people, but I shut down, yeah. Right? Then the anxious avoidance style... anxious attachment style is generally that a child learned early on that someone will be... intermittently be there for them.
Okay.
So, for example, one moment you might have a caregiver who's listening, who's doing all the things you need, and then the next moment they've disappeared. Or maybe the next moment they've switched to needing you more than they can be there for you. So you learn intermittently people will be there for me. So how do you adapt? Well, you can't use logic or shutting down. Instead, what you do is you initiate contact as many times as you can, knowing that at some point that person will be there for you. So like a puppy, they're bouncing around like, hey, I'm here, wanna hang out? How about now? How about now? How about now? Now?
Yes. Yeah.
And as a kid, it's so smart, right? They often get described as clingy or needy children, but that's not a negative. That's an incredibly smart way of ensuring you get your needs met. And as an adult, when you have an avoidant attachment style, you tend to engage in push-pull behavior. So for example, you might go on a date, seem really keen, and then shut down and push people away for a bit until you feel calm again, and then you reconnect.
Mm.
As an anxious person, you might start reading into the messages what wasn't there. Are they trying to reject me?
Mm.
Are they not interested? But your coping skill is attention, right? So you meet someone, you're excited, you give them attention. You think that they're pulling away, so you initiate more interaction. Do you see what I mean? So you just keep giving more and more attention to this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If the other person can tolerate that, fantastic. But sometimes what can end up happening is you end up overwatering the seeds of a new relationship and drowning it. So they're both incredibly smart ways of adapting as a child
mm-hmm.
that can sometimes get in the way of you being able to connect as an adult.
Okay. That is the clearest and crispest way that I've ever heard it explained in my life.
Oh, that's so nice.
It's actually amazing. Wow. What about fearful avoidant?
Yes.
What about that? Because I feel like isn't that anxious avoidant? Is that what they say? I know there's so many, but yeah.
So... it depends. So some people talk about it as if there are many, many different styles. Sometimes fearful avoidant goes into the disorganized attachment pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's classified into different areas.
Okay.
So it depends. But basically, some people are a little bit of two. So, for example, desperately wanting a relationship, but the minute someone gets close, it's too overwhelming. So they run away.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Mm. Yeah. What does that
say? But just so you know, we can all earn secure attachment, right? Because you hear this and you think, oh my word, I'm doomed.
I was just about to ask, can we free ourselves from these things? Because the way that we've attached ourselves to these titles, I know we're a society that likes labels and boxes and
yes.
things and positions and places and things that just want to make us make sense of ourselves.
Yes.
So, but then when... you know, if secure is here and then avoided is
yeah.
there and anxious is there and yeah. then there's disorganized and you're just like, I did a lot of hand gestures, by the way, for people. That,
oh, I loved it. I loved all of them.
I guess it's about trying to become secure, is
yeah.
it not?
Yeah. So we can earn secure attachment. I think there's something I just want to add here, which is psychology can make everything sound like a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It can make everything sound like, it's pathological. Sometimes we can hear psychology when it's without nuance. Yes. As, oh my word, I have a problem that's unchangeable. I would never have written a manual for being human if I didn't believe people could change. If I didn't know that our brains are adapting each day. So whatever you hear about psychology, if it ever gets heavy, you can always find a way towards the light. And when it comes to attachment styles, yes, we call it earned security.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the simplest ways to earn secure attachment is to actually have people with secure attachment styles around you.
Okay.
People. So, for example, if you have an anxious attachment style, you will notice that if someone is able to consistently show you that they're not going to disappear on you, they're not going to intermittently be there for you like your early relationships, the alarm bells in your head stop ringing. You start to feel more relaxed. that puppy-like behavior becomes charming and not driven by anxiety, but driven by desire to connect. If you have an avoidant attachment style and someone allows you, I suppose, to keep pulling in and disconnecting, allows you space, but also gives you firm boundaries, as in, I'll be here, but I need X from you in return, you also start to relax and recognize you can disconnect without having to push people away. So having people in your life, particularly people you date who have a secure attachment style, really helps. You know, one of the reasons we do therapy rather than the main reason that therapy is different to reading a self-help book, actually, is because people heal in relationships. So often as a therapist, and certainly, you know, my therapist, I definitely have gained so much from, because your therapist offers you a secure attachment. They are consistently there for you. They consistently listen. You know that they will be there. So we heal in relationships. So that's one of many ways in which you can move towards a secure attachment style. But the other thing is, if anyone's listening and they're unsure of their attachment style, buy a manual for being human and read about each attachment style, because there are so many things you can do to get there.
And Dr. Soph doesn't even ease you in. It's literally bang, first chapter. you're fine. Like, it's not going to be like, you know, well in there.
You don't have to root around. Page five.
But thank you for that. I think that should be a lot clearer for people to kind of get their head around. Because I think a lot of this stuff is good to understand and I think we're going through, especially in the wake of COVID and the pandemic, people are really trying to understand themselves better because they have to sit with themselves a lot of the time. There's a lot of questions that are being raised and things of that nature. And I think that what you've created here is an amazing piece of just literature for people to kind of literally
connect
with themselves in a way that makes sense to them. But the book is great. It's got loads of different things. I would love to have got into the trauma responses and other things, but you know, we can talk about that next time, because I feel like I'm gonna probably come back. Actually, I probably will come back with a different episode around a different chapter. And I think
we'll
break down the book and workshop it. But
I'm so game.
But yeah, so that was really good. So you probably said this, but I want you to answer this question around, so what is it that we need to know and learn about being human that we have forgotten or have not been taught, in your opinion?
Okay. I could answer that in many ways, so I'll go for something simple, because when I get excited, I talk a lot, so I'm going to calm it down, which is almost everything that you do as a human makes sense. That stuff that you worry about, that you think, oh my word, it's only me that experiences this, there's something wrong with me, is absolutely shared by others and is likely to be very, very normal. And almost every symptom that we see come into a clinic as a psychologist that people worry about, such as, let's think of some examples, perfectionism, emotional eating, literally everything that everyone does, avoidant attachment styles, so relationship issues, isn't something wrong with you. It's an attempt or a strategy that you often unconsciously made in order to stay safe in the world. You know, most people become perfectionists because they figure out at some point in their life, if I can do everything perfect, I'll be worthy of love. An avoidant attachment style arises because people think, people won't want to be there or can't be there for me when I need them to, so I have to do this on my own. And our brain then tries to push people away, because if we allow them in, we feel unsafe and we feel like they'll hurt us. Mm-hmm. Emotional eating, for example, is a very smart way of managing your emotions in the absence of another coping skill. If you think about, for example, babies, you know, they are most soothed when they're being fed by their caregiver. They are often, after they've done something really good or they've had a birthday, they are treated with cakes and parties. So when, for example, we're struggling, it makes sense that you would turn to some kind of treat, because it takes us back to those early memories. It fills our bellies and makes us feel grounded. So almost everything that you're criticizing yourself for ever worry about is likely to be something very normal that can be understood and is probably a very smart way that you adapt, you know, you adapted, that maybe just needs to be replaced. So you're not alone, you're normal, and you are human.
Oh, thanks so much, Dr. Sarif, for that. And I think that's one of the big takeaways of this show as well, is just to recognize and understand that we aren't alone. We have a sense of belonging that is, you know, building this community here. This is what, you know, this is where we sit. We are together in this. And it's okay to not be okay. And it's okay to feel in the way that we do.
Yeah. And the more we share that we struggle with how we feel, the more likely we are to connect with people around us. Yeah. You know, keeping up that facade of I'm totally okay normally holds people at arm's length, making them think, oh no, I'm not okay, but they are okay. What's going on? So yeah, community, being okay and being real with who we are is how we're going to make change in this world.
Okay. Got a question. If you could speak to your, you know, 15-year-old self right now, what would you say to her?
You're good enough as you are. You don't need to pretend to be someone you're not. And when you're 18 and have panic attacks, don't worry. Someone will understand you. You don't need to think that you're losing your mind. And in fact, it's going to be one of the most important things that happened to you, because that's how you'll become a psychologist.
Yeah. You want to see how it works and why it happened.
Yeah.
I have this vision of you just like getting on the back of a Harley with like,
and
just like, you know, cruising the streets, like running.
Yeah, I want that vision to be true. I'm going to rewrite my memories so that that one is true.
You know what? I mean, when we look back on who we were when I was what, 18, I was just not this person.
No, me neither.
And if anything, that is one thing that we should recognize about change, that when we look back, do we see the same person? And I think that's something that we really need to recognize. Because everybody gets so stuck in the in the here, but they don't recognize where we're coming from a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that change will come in the future, no matter how bleak it feels right now.
Yeah. So I've got this playlist. It's a mishmash of all of the kind of personalities of my guests. So,
there is
no genre request. There is no anything. It's just a song that represents you.
Okay. So I love this question. Just so you know, the whole way through school, my biggest fear was someone would ask me what music I liked. So it's quite funny that we're talking about this, because I felt like it was a test.
It was a trap.
Yes. Like, but don't worry, I'm not there anymore. I can definitely share with you a song. So there's this song called Love and Hate in a Different Time. Okay. It's by, and it's funny because I've never said the name out loud, Gabrielle's or Gabriel's.
Okay. No idea.
And what I love about it is not only do I love the title, you know, if we think about A Manual for Being Human, what I'm saying is that there are things from different times, loves of people and the hates that we come across or perceive that shape who we are. So firstly, I love the title. Secondly, it's got a strong 70s vibe, even though it's present day. Yeah. And it just makes me feel really sassy. Yeah. Like I like to put it on in the background and kind of like, you know, no one listening can see me dancing in front of you, but it just makes me want to move. And it's just absolutely the song I will have destroyed probably by the time your playlist comes out, because I tend to over listen to something until I cannot listen to it anymore. But it feels like exactly, it summarizes how I want to feel this summer in London.
Okay, remind me of the name again. Love and Hate
in a Different Time.
Okay, so I'm gonna get that down. But I do get trapped in a song loop myself. I will play it. I literally have, at the point of recording, I've been playing Burna Boy, Georgia Smith, and Wizkid, and it's very, very particular songs. Like, it's not even like I'm playing their albums and I'm like delving into music. I'm playing like four songs,
and
I put them in a queue, and that's it.
Yes,
that's all it is.
I do exactly the same.
And then it just messes
when I discover
my
new song.
Yeah,
sorry.
It messes my Spotify algorithm up, because then it tells you at the end of the year, oh, your most played songs. It'll be like that song, but like I was trapped in the song loop.
When I discover a new song, I feel both elated and devastated because I know that this is the highway to hating it.
Yep, I'll be like, I'm stuck here now. This is where I'm at. This is life right now. This is me. I'm here. Yes. This is what I'm doing. And two books that my listeners can, that, you know, we can tap into to get some insights.
So I'm going to spare you on saying my own book because I've talked about it the whole way through. Instead, I'm going to talk about Attached, which you've already mentioned. I just think it is the single best psychology book written or published, at least to date.
Yep.
That makes psychology and relationships and us understanding ourselves accessible. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the second one is The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. Have you read it?
Beautiful choices, both of them.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Attached had me by the throat, like most of the time I was
from
reading
page
it.
One.
It literally just gripped me and just said, look, this is what we're doing. Okay. You can't close this book. You can't do it.
Yeah. Also, did you have those moments where you're like, oh, I thought that was a personal quirk? It turns out no. I am textbook. Every page, I was like, no, that's my personality.
You are not original, my G. That's basically what I was being told.
Yes. Honestly, that's what I read on every page. Yes.
Beautiful books. I loved The Midnight Library. I think that is such a beautiful concept. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Surf, do you want to explain a little bit about...
Yes, so it's actually a fiction book, and it follows the story of a woman who wants to end her life. But I think what's so spectacular about it is often when we want to learn about psychology, when we read self-help or when someone gives us advice, we often feel quite defensive. Even if we want that advice, it can feel quite patronizing and quite irritating. The beauty of The Midnight Library is you're learning real important life lessons through someone else's story. He's teaching us psychology without making us realize, without letting us know that he's actually giving us life advice. It's spectacular. The story is wonderful. It's beautifully written. And in fact, if you can listen to it, the audiobook is stellar.
That's what I did. And I lived through that book. It was amazing. Great. Great stuff. Well, thanks so much. Where can people find you?
So, well, Dr. Soph is very easy to find. So my Instagram is @_DRSOPH. There is someone else who is @DrSoph, and I really want to know who they are. So you can find me on Instagram. Mm-hmm. You can find me on my website, drsoph.com. So drsoph.com. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You can find me in Amazon right now to buy the book.
And buy the book, you should. Thanks so much for joining me this week, Dr. Surf. Beautiful conversation. We will be back for the trauma responses. That's what we're going to be
doing. I bloody loved it. Thank you so much.
No worries. And everybody else, we'll catch you next week. As ever, thank you so much for listening to the show. This episode was produced by Pure Creation Media over with Ryan Niall, my phenomenal producer. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you again to Dr. Sophie Mort for joining me on today's show. And I look forward to catching you all next week when we talk about The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris.